in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Rachel Howard, whose new book is The Risk of Us, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Rachel Howard earned her MFA in fiction from Warren Wilson College and is the author of a memoir, The Lost Night. She is the recipient of a McDowell Colony Fellowship, and her fiction, essays, and dance criticism have appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and elsewhere. Her debut novel, The Risk of Us, concerns a woman who longs to be a mother and the captivating yet troubled child she and her husband take in. When I spoke with Rachel Howard, I asked her to talk about what came first when it comes to the two storylines that are depicted in the novel. One concerns the narrator's own traumatic background, and the other concerns the narrator and her husband Sebastian fostering a child in need. So we begin with Rachel's answer. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have all the notes because I write in longhand before I take anything to the computer, and I have them all in a box, and I went through them just a couple of weeks ago, and I found the very first notes that I made, and I was kind of surprised because in my memory, it really all came together around remembering actually seeing a brochure from a foster services agency that said, "We need families that take risks." I remember that was a catalyzing moment for the book where I thought, oh, there's a story and a situation here to explore that's perfect for fiction. Why would they advertise for families that say, you know, that are willing to take risks?
Right.
But when I went back to my notes, actually the earliest note I had was about the narrator's ex-husband.
Max.
And so, yes, it Max. So she, you know, she has her background is her father was murdered in her own home, which is an element I took from my own life because mm-hmm. I found it fictionally useful. And I think what happened is I started taking notes on her. She has all of this guilt about her marriage to her first husband because she was young and she hadn't really... I guess the word is processed, or she hadn't really faced the trauma yet, and she needed him desperately, and he was willing to put up with her panic attacks and, you know, behavior that even when you're in your 20s is very much like a child who's going through panic attacks and tantrums.
Mm-hmm.
And he was willing to put up with that in her 20s when she hadn't faced her trauma yet. And that was why she married him. And she has this tremendous guilt about that, even years after divorcing him. And actually, those were the notes that I took that were the catalyst for the book. Because as you're saying, yeah, then there's these two storylines that are speaking to each other. The trauma from the narrator's past, the woman who's trying to adopt the 7-year-old girl Marisa, and now how she's trying to bring something that she's learned from that to her relationship, to trying to understand Marisa in her panic attacks.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, the panic attacks that she had in her 20s really do sort of reflect some of the behavior that Marisa has as a 7-year-old. There's violence, there's acting out, there's shouting, there's kind of a I don't know, out of body kind of sense at times.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me if I'm wrong. The narrator herself has no name in this story. Am I right, or did I miss it?
No, it's not there.
Okay.
I didn't notice that until pretty deep into the writing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't a decision at the outset.
Right. And at first I was thinking, oh, so she and her husband don't have names. And then I remembered, no, he does. He's Sebastian.
Yeah.
So once you realized she didn't have a name, what made you decide to keep her without a name? I mean, she's called Mommy sometimes, but...
Yeah. She's called just Mommy. Well, she's speaking the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she speaks at first to her husband, Sebastian, right as Marisa is starting out, you know, being in a new placement. It's her fifth or sixth home that she's been moved to, and they're all hoping it's going to be permanent. So she starts by speaking to her husband. And then the next chapter, she's trying to speak to Marisa. And then as it goes on, she's trying to figure out how to speak to both of them, or both of them at once, or how do we all really come together as a family with a perspective, a groundedness that can hold all of us. It just it felt right not to have her name in it. I think in part because really as I was writing the book, I would not re-enter the writing until I felt that I was in the right mindset. So I'm not a person who has the luxury of being really fussy about when and where I write, although I do now have an office and I write there 3 hours a day. But at the time, I didn't have an office, and I was writing at a bench on the street. I was writing at the, you know, community pool, and I was writing in my car. But I was always pausing, sometimes listening to certain music, sometimes rereading certain things, sometimes touching certain talismans to put myself in the right mindset of honoring the little girl's pain in the book, because to me that was the thing most worthy of honoring in the center of the book, was the pain that Marisa, the 7-year-old, has gone through first in what she lived that ended her up in the foster care system, and then in you know, a lot of terrible situations that she had to bounce through before this family even has a chance to come together. And I think because that was at the center of the book for me, I felt like using this woman who is speaking to them, it's not a device exactly, but it's just the point of view that makes exploring this possible.
Right.
It's the point of view that gives enough reader to just explore the situation for all three of them. And I wanted that then, you know, that it's not about, in a strange way, it's not about the mother or the woman who wants to be the mother in this foster care situation, that she's the point of view entry, but it's really about the pain at the center of this.
Yeah.
And it felt right not to have her even have a name.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, until we've started having this actual conversation, I hadn't thought about this before, but I think that her not having a name made me feel more connected to the material in a way, because it kind of makes more universal my own empathy for what she's going through and what we go through as, you know, people, either in families or from families. I think that's just interesting to me now that I'm thinking about it. Let's see. This is a quote from one of the parenting books that's given to this family by social services. And I think you used, for the most part, real books for these quotes. So I'm sorry I'm not mentioning which book this comes from, but maybe I can look at the end and add this to my interview later. But the traumatized child becomes the associational connection to the parent's unresolved trauma and loss issues, shifting the parent into a deep fear state. There are these moments in the book where there are quotes from, you know, resources that have been given to her. And there's also a lot of conflicting advice given. It sounds like a very confusing path for new parents. And they're also always being looked at and tested and even judged. So I was wondering if you can speak to this and to also to the way you conducted your research.
Yeah. What I did is I added notes for the sources
right
to the end, acknowledging that most of them, I think all but one or two of the quotes came from actual parenting books. And I liked using them because instead of then the narrator having to explain to the reader how she feels under surveillance, or, you know, the level of self-scrutiny and then scrutiny from others and those things coming to conflict you're in when you're in the foster care system, I could just show it. I could just
right.
have her read that quote
right.
and know all too well that she felt that applied to her. And that's why I wanted to use as a fictional element her having this murder of her own father in the background, because then I think the self-scrutiny and the self-questioning and the feeling judged by others is even heightened. She's coming in hoping that she feels that she went through this trauma in her childhood, and then, yes, belatedly in life, but eventually she faced it in a profound way, and feels that it's actually now a positive trait that she made it through. She knows that you can have a new life after trauma. It doesn't have to negatively define your whole life. Mm-hmm. And she wants to pass that on to a child with her own trauma, and she feels like it'll give her a point of empathy. But then what happens, you know, when you're in the foster care system is she has many different professionals looking at her, and they're all coming in with theories, as we all have to.
Right.
You have theories about how experiences affect people. And before you even know the person, you have to try to apply the theory. And so now everyone is looking at her and saying, well, I don't know if I believe that you're really over that trauma, or, you know, how do I know that this trauma background isn't going to get triggered and is suddenly going to make you a worse parent, or this trauma is the real source of your irritation when Marisa is having panic attacks, or when she's kicking you or screaming at you bad words, and the real source of your irritation is your trauma. So yeah, all of a sudden it's not going to be clear cut whether her having lived through this and having a point of empathy is considered a bonus.
Right. And even her husband says something along those lines at one point. And and it made me feel for her. And, you know, I mean, I feel like we all are affected by our life experiences as our lives play out as we get into adulthood. And why wouldn't this be true for all of us, you know? And yet she's being so closely scrutinized by everybody. Now you do have, and you mentioned this, that you've written a memoir about your own past and your father's murder. Now, do you also have a connection to the fostering storyline?
Yeah, I do. My husband and I did adopt a child out of foster care. And like the couple in the book, we wanted to adopt not an infant or a toddler, but a child who was slightly older and maybe had already gone through a few placements. We were hoping to help someone who maybe needed the help a little more than some other children in the system. So definitely in my own experience, I felt very much under surveillance, and I wondered if most other foster parents felt the same way. And if they did, I hoped to write a story that they could relate to and feel less alone in that experience with. At the same time, there's a lot of elements that also changed and that are completely invented, and it actually gets a little difficult for me to track point by point, because when you get into the writing and you say this is fiction, and you have that intention from the moment you walk into the story, then whether something lines up with your life in this strange way ends up becoming coincidental and beside the point, and you stop tracking things. And so sometimes things that you invent, you actually feel like they happened in your real life, and vice versa. And it's a little perilous that way, but yeah, it was my process.
I imagine. Now, this borders on personal, and if you'd rather not answer, that's fine. I totally get it. But is your child of an age that you were able to ask him or her for feedback on what you were doing, or not really?
No, she's just not, was not the right time.
Yeah. Okay.
And I did grapple with that. I did speak to people who wrote memoirs, who had talked to their children about that, but the circumstances were so different.
Sure.
So no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, have you had your readers kind of approach you or contact you to talk about their reactions to this material, given their own personal experiences?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have heard from a lot of, just parents in general. But I mean, that's been sort of an interesting, I feel like I hear from a lot of parents who say you don't have to be I'm not a foster parent. I've had no experience with the system, and yet I still really relate to the human dilemmas in this book.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I've also, of course, heard from foster parents, from adoptive parents who did it not through the foster system, but in other ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually got a good friend who I was thinking I might send my copy of the book to when we're finished here, because I thought she might really enjoy it because she adopted a child.
Yeah, and actually a key thing about it, I mean, the idea that the title, The Risk of Us and the Risks We Take in Parenting, I mean, I thought it was an interesting situation because here they are, they're doing it in a way when they're intentionally choosing that risk, those risks, but I feel like they apply to all parenting, even biological, yeah. And that we can forget that, you know, there are no guarantees of what kind of relationship you're going to have or what kind of child you're going to be raising or what that child's issues are going to be in biological parenting. But we have ways of just kind of forgetting that and assuming what the situation is going to be. Whereas in this charged situation, there's no looking away from the risks involved. But one of the most touching reactions I had was from a parent whose biological child is just now entering a difficult period at age 13. And sometimes with any child, you get into a situation you don't know, is the relationship going to improve or not? Are we going to make it out of this as a family or not?
Right.
You know, what is the, and is there going to be a happy ending? And that was why I wrote the book when I did, because I could feel I was in this moment of being very in touch with the reality that you don't know the ending when you're in a tense situation like this, when, you know, Marisa's not sure that she, at points that she wants to be adopted by them. They're not sure at several points whether they can make good, the couple, on this commitment to unconditional love that they made without having even met the child. And they do love her, but there's you know, people's health at on the line, and there's also the consideration of, you know, what is ultimately best for everyone is sometimes not the sentimental thing, and they're all grappling with that. And some of the most touching responses I've had are from parents with biological children who are in the middle of grappling with that too.
Yeah. Yeah. In the description of the novel, there's this one little blurb that says, a poignant, dazzling debut novel about a woman who longs to be a mother and the captivating yet troubled child she and her husband take in. And the idea of longing to be a mother, and I feel like women in particular, as girls, get this whole, you know, story in their heads about what it will be like to be a mother. And many of us long to be mothers. And so we kind of write the story before we get to it. And that's like this total setup, no matter what kind of mother you're going to be and what kind of child you're going to raise, whether it's through biological means or the foster system or adoption. You know, we sort of set ourselves up by having a picture in our minds by the time we're 12 years old, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that profoundly. And the narrator of the novel, like me, is influenced by both Christian and Buddhist spiritualities. And I think that's a thread through the book. I completely agree with what you've said. And there's an idea in Buddhism that, story can be very helpful in our lives. It helps us shape our sense of self, and it helps us think about the future and have hope. But as you're saying, if we come in clutching these storylines that we've already been given without questioning, and we get wrapped up in thinking that the reality in front of us needs to match the story, then that's the recipe for suffering.
Yes.
Sometimes the biggest, hardest thing we need to do is drop the story.
Yes.
And I think that's absolutely true for parenting, and just be with the reality in front of us, not knowing what the story is yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I just read a little paragraph and then we can talk a little bit about it?
Sure.
So this is pretty early in the book, and they have taken Marisa in. I'll just read it. Mainly, though, little one, she's addressing the child in her narrative. This isn't in dialogue. Mainly, though, little one, you back off on daddy. Save the worst of the morning screaming for when daddy is out of town. The descriptor tantrum does not suffice to convey the oral reality of these episodes to anyone I confide in. So one morning when daddy's in San Francisco and I'm trying to get you to put your shoes on, I press the red record button on the phone. I need you to take deep breaths and stop yelling, Marisa. My heart is racing. Here, feel, okay? Let's take deep breaths. I'm not yelling. You're the one yelling. Stop yelling. But I'm not yelling, Marisa. I'm not yelling. When I play it back hours later, the voices don't sound the way I expect. The child is screeching, yes. The woman I hear isn't yelling, that's true, but the calm in her voice is almost worse somehow, eerie, like a captor's. I wanted to read that partly to convey the way that you show us how hard it is. It's just heartbreaking sometimes, the journey they take with this little girl. But also that need to capture the moment, to be sure that she is interpreting things right, that things are what she thinks they are, and to be able to record it and revisit it and check that she isn't losing her mind. I thought that was a really important moment in this story. And it also just shows the emotional highs and lows that they go through. I mean, actually, it doesn't show the highs. There are moments where the child is just lovely.
So, there are a lot of highs,
A lot of highs and some lows. So I don't know that I have a question around that, but I liked that moment where I would be recording things. I mean, I just know I would. I would need to double check how I'm doing, you know, later, because you lose yourself in high emotions sometimes. And I don't know. Do you have anything that you would add to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you sound like maybe you've done some parenting. Are you parent yourself?
I am. Like you can I raised boys, and one in particular was a challenge, but he's now in his late 20s, and it's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's so funny because you were asking about other people's responses, and another even, you know, I mean, this is part of the thing. I mean, I think there's a stigma on foster children that I would hope that they don't have to live through in their lives, you know, where they feel like they're branded as the difficult ones and the hard ones and the bad ones. And I don't think they need to feel that stigma, because they're capable of so much more resilience than the common narrative that we get about them or that they get about themselves lets them see. And I've seen tremendous resilience in my own experiences with my own former foster child and knowing other families' former foster children. But then also, biological children can be just as difficult certain. And one respondent to the novel, you know, she told me at length that she had one easy child and she had another child who was just like Marisa. And that was just how the cards played out for her. So, yeah, I'm. It's nice to hear that all parents can relate.
Oh, absolutely.
And that passage, I was really excited when I got that passage down of her making the recording and then listening back to it for the reason you described, but then also for that moment of her thinking that, you know, she's going to come across on the recording as calm and loving and being a good parent.
Right.
And actually feeling this eeriness in the control of her own voice and actually having a moment of, oh, but that's how it sounds to Marisa. It sounds too eerie and distant and unemotional.
Right.
And then also maybe realizing, because what I also found interesting in this whole complex was there's an urge even from this would-be mother who's trying to be so aware to judge the previous foster parents and say, oh, well, those five earlier placements, you know, they just weren't committed enough. Or maybe they didn't stay calm enough in the hardest moments. And at that moment, I think she realizes, you know what, they were doing their best and I'm doing my best and I'm probably not doing that much better than they did. And so we need to remove judgment from this and all do our best.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that was interesting to me was Marisa is able to convey to her what some of the previous placements were like. And the one right before her is somebody she called, is it Aunt Annie? Did she call her Aunt Annie or just Annie?
Oh, it was Auntie, yeah.
Oh, Auntie. You know, and this woman was maybe somebody who shouted a little bit more and lost her cool a little bit more. And there are times where it's very clear that Marisa was more comfortable with that.
Right. Yeah. And that was also an interesting emotional reality for some foster children that I wanted to bring into the novel, that if you're used to being yelled at, that feels like emotional engagement to you.
Right.
And if what you desperately need is connection and emotional engagement, then you're actually going to want the yelling.
Yes.
So how do you build in different kinds of bonding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You, at one point in the book, you refer to something called the memoirist's curse. And the line is, I blab, spill my honest to God feelings, whereas her husband is perhaps maybe less likely to always talk about his feelings. So as a memoirist yourself, I'm having a hard time with that word. Can you talk about this? Is this a thing? Once you've written a memoir, you're going to always tell your story.
I mean, it definitely is for me. I think it was even before I wrote my first book, the memoir. And now I'm working on another memoir, and I toggle back and forth between fiction and memoir. To me, they do feel, though, like they have a very different impetus. That in memoir, it's about, at least for me, self-investigation. And so it needs to be about myself, and it needs to be about figuring out what actually happened and the sense that I made of what actually happened, because I'm trying to make sense of a passage in my life in order to move on to a new part of life. And that wasn't the impetus for the novel. The novel, there was nothing that I needed to figure out about me. There was nothing cathartic about it. It was really feeling like there's this pain that needs to be honored in the middle of all of this. And there's this crucible. And also tightly contained by time, because it's, you know, this 7-year-old girl is going to come live with them, and they're either going to make it to finalizing it as an adoption or not. And that's going to happen within a year and a half to 2 years. And so I just realized there was this crucible for exploring how pain and beauty exist side by side, and these moments of intense tension and anger and impossibility 1 second, and, you know, sudden connection and possibility the next. And I thought that's material for fiction. But when the self-investigation impetus strikes, I definitely go back to memoir. And I think I've always had journals since I was 10 years old. And I have continuous journals that began when I was 17 that I've written in every 2 or 3 days. So I have them from age 17 to age 43 now.
Okay.
And yeah. And I teach writing. And so I often encounter and have to help people who are inhibited by what are my family going to think, and how can I really give myself the permission and the freedom and the privacy to get whatever it is down on the page. And so I've learned to be aware of when that's happening for other people and sensitive to it. But I think for me, even from my teenage years, there was just this relief of freedom of whatever happened. I'm a human being having human experiences, and there are probably other people who have had similar ones. And so why should I feel shame about that?
Mm-hmm.
I have always had this candor. and then I had to go back, of course, especially in memoir, and think about where that candor needs to be checked. But that part of it is hard for me.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I wanted to ask you, Rachel, if you've read anything lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Well, I mean, my favorite book of last year, like most people, was Tommy Orange's They're There.
Mm.
I mean, it knocked me out, and I returned to it. I just now started Keith Lemon's Heavy, and it's amazing right out of the gate. The thing I'm rereading, actually, though, and doing community discussions on is the stories of Chekhov.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, and I would recommend those. I have a community group of 10 people, and we're doing our fourth and final session this week on reading Chekhov for our times, because it's, he's the ultimate in letting go of judgment for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
and just exploring moral nuance and ambiguity, and always coming at a point of compassion, even for the most despicable, outwardly despicable characters. And so that's what I've been rereading, and in these times where so much of our everyday conversations is about judging one another and being outraged, it's nice to come back to Chekhov. Mm-hmm. And try to find that point of compassion first.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's great. And actually, I have a question about advice specifically now for writers. So we've already talked a little bit about the point of view in this book. And there's this great moment at the end of the book where your narrator, who's also a writing teacher, discusses pronouns in prose. And in a way, she gives us a little bit of a map to understanding the way this book was written. And that is, you know, it addresses both Seb and Marisa as you at different points. And as in the title, the family is us. And we also get information in the book from letters and books, and as I said, that recording. So I just wonder if you could offer advice for writers of fiction who might be struggling with point of view and how to find a way into the right point of view for their story.
Yeah. Point of view is my obsession.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
I did an MFA at Warren Wilson College, which mm-hmm. I'm so glad I did. It was an amazing experience. And my obsession there was point of view. And I wrote like a 50-page essay on omniscient point of view. So I can talk all day about, I get really passionate. And I have very strident opinions about it. Because I feel that people are being too limited and too policed in point of view, typically, and the feedback that they're getting, and they're limiting themselves from experimenting in possibly fruitful ways unnecessarily by this idea of getting it right.
I agree with you. And I think as beginning writers, it's really important to understand point of view and to know when you're jumping from one person's perspective to another. But as long as you know that you're doing it, it can get really interesting, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It takes more work. You can't be schematic about it. You have to be more attentive line by line to how the consciousness is shifting, but it's worth the work. So, I think my advice would be, I mean, first, like, to read widely different writers using radically different points of view. And then to try it out in your own writing in really low stakes way. Just choosing scenes at random and trying them in third and trying them in second, trying them, in changing point of view frequently and not trying them in from a collective we point of view, just to see what happens alchemically, because of course it's not just changing pronouns, it's the whole imaginative orientation of the writing consciousness shifts, and the whole relationship with the reader shifts. I mean, I think the reason the kind of second person that I used in The Risk of Us, where the speaker, the narrator of the book, is talking to a character within the book, I'm actually noticing now, like, wow, that's happening a lot these days lately, especially in memoir. I'm noticing my book is not the only one.
Right, sure.
And the reason being that it creates this really useful spaciousness for intense material, because the reader's not being spoken to. The speaker is not trying to convince the reader of anything or emote to the reader. The speaker of the book is talking to someone else, and the reader gets to be an eavesdropper on the outside, which then gives them this freedom of, oh, okay, well, if I'm not the one who needs to be convinced of anything, I can just kind of be curious about listening in on this intimate conversation. It's really this bigger alchemical thing that happens between the material and the point of view that you've got to experiment with in low stakes way for a while. And then once you find something where you did the laboratory experiment, and, oh my gosh, like that really blew up in a fantastic way. And I love what resulted from it. To just have the clarity of your own intention with that. I actually did take the first two chapters of The Risk of Us to a writing conference, where there was a great workshop leader. But one of the comments he made was, oh, this point of view, first she's talking to the husband, then she's talking to the little girl. That seems it's a little complicated. And, you know, definitely the hint there was, I don't know if you want to do this.
Right.
Fortunately, I was at a stage in my writing life where I just was, I've got to know my own intentions and stick by them, play them out. So yeah. I said, yep, it's a little complicated and I know I can do it.
Did that come up at all when you were trying to get the book published? Did anybody have concerns about that?
And then, no, it didn't.
No, interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's great. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. The name of the novel is The Risk of Us, a novel by Rachel Howard, and it's published by HMH, which is Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Rachel, so enjoyed your book. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you so much. I love talking about writing with you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that, again, was an interview with the author Rachel Howard. We discussed her novel, The Risk of Us, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You can learn more at rachelhoward.com, and she tweets at Rachel A. Howard. So one quick note, the quote that I read during the interview from her book, which quoted another book, the quote about trauma came from the book Beyond Consequences, Logic and Control, a love-based approach to helping attachment-challenged children with severe behaviors. And that's by Heather T. Forbes and B. Brian Post. Just since I hadn't had it on hand when I mentioned it during the interview, I wanted to mention it now. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Rachel Howard, and I personally can't wait to try it. She says that it's a somewhat arbitrary structure that she came up with when she was teaching undergraduate creative writing at Warren Wilson College. And she's had some luck with it as well. Write a lyric essay about one of the three great forces of life, sex, death, or love. The essay should never name whether it is about sex, death, or love, or use the word. The essay will consist of the following sections. First, a pure description of a significant place from your past. This could be a room, a street corner, the back of a car. Use as many concrete sensory details as possible. 10 sentences maximum for that part. Next, a character sketch of someone from your life. 6 sentences maximum. Then one short description of a song. You may quote lyrics, but not use the words sex, death, or love. That's 3 sentences max. And then a scene with dialogue, 1 scene, any length. And finally, one semi-obscure scientific fact that does not seem obviously connected to the rest of the essay, but which metaphorically is. And that's 4 sentences maximum. Rachel says that it's an unusual exercise, but give it a try and you may well be surprised at the experience. And after the exercise generates the rough draft, you can move the sections around and start breaking the rules to fit the emerging organic form. So I thought that was really fun, and I loved that it was so specific. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.